If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Whether you're working out or working on your high score, you never settle for less. So why should it be any different when you choose your protein drink? Rockin' Protein comes in three delicious flavors, has 30 grams of protein, and is always made with fresh milk. So you're never left with that chalky taste. Rockin' Protein. Never settle for less than a great-tasting, high-quality protein drink. Visit rockinprotein.com to find Rockin' Protein wherever you are. Rockin' Protein and Shamrock Farms are registered trademarks of Shamrock Foods Company.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Wearing a Men's Warehouse outfit makes you confident, like you could do anything, so you dance like no one is watching, even though everyone is watching. Because of the Men's Warehouse outfit, you interview like the job is already yours because it is. Because of the Men's Warehouse outfit, you golf as if the rules don't apply to you because you're too well-dressed for rules. Because of the Men's Warehouse outfit. At Men's Warehouse, get measured, get fitted, get hot, get confident in everything from tailored suits to underwear and all the stuff in between. Love the way you look at Men's Warehouse.
Once he was persuaded to come to the door, quite naked, he saw the sky, he saw the planes, he ran back indoors, he put his trousers on, and he put a call straight through to the United Press office in San Francisco, telling them what had happened.
That was Nicholas Best explaining how news of the attack on Pearl Harbor spread around the world.
Now, it's difficult to separate the contribution of few geniuses from the common contribution of everybody, but few geniuses certainly existed in the history of science and had an immense influence.
And that was Carlo Rovelli discussing the history of physics.
You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to our first podcast of December 2016. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. 75 years ago this month, Japan attacked the US naval base at Pearl Harbor, destroying hundreds of planes, damaging numerous ships, and killing over 2,000 men. This was the day of infamy that prompted American entry into the Second World War, turning it into a truly global conflict. Historical author Nicholas Best has written a new book on the events and aftermath of Pearl Harbor. And I caught up with him a little while back to get his take on one of the defining moments of the 20th century. Could you just give us a brief idea of what the state of the war was, particularly in the Pacific, prior to the Pearl Harbor attacks?
Well, the situation in the Pacific was that Japan was involved in a very long and expensive war with China that wasn't going well. The Japanese had invaded expecting to win a war in 3 months, and they'd actually been at war for 4 years and were running out of the supplies they needed to continue the war, and that means oil and things like that. They had also invaded Indochina, French Indochina, now known as Vietnam. And as a result, the United States had cut off all help for Japan, and they had put an embargo on the supplies that Japan needed to continue their war in China, especially oil. And so the Japanese needed to capture places like Malaya and Java that were very mineral rich and could supply them with oil to continue their war against China. And to do that, to capture Malaya and Java, they first had to put the American fleet at Pearl Harbor out of action for at least 6 months.
From the American point of view, do you think there was anything they could have done differently to have avoided this attack taking place?
The Americans were most anxious to come to peaceful settlement with Japan. But the problem was that the Americans insisted that Japan must withdraw from China and French Indochina, and the Japanese didn't want to do that because they would lose face, and they felt that if they did that, they might also have to withdraw from their colony of Korea. So from the American side, there was very little the Americans could do short of accepting that the Japanese could rampage around the Pacific wherever they liked. And the Americans couldn't stand for that. So, no, the Americans were stuck with the situation that was beyond their control.
As we all know, the attack on Pearl Harbor is one of the great surprise attacks in modern history. How do you think the Japanese were able, in a fairly modern time, to achieve such a level of surprise?
Well, there was a lack of radar, for one thing, and that part of the Pacific is enormous. And it was simply a question of being able to see the other side coming. The Americans didn't have it covered. Nobody had it covered. And, of course, the Americans weren't expecting it. They knew that the Japanese were about to attack somewhere because they're from radio intercepts and spies. They knew it was going to happen. They looked at the map and they thought, goodness me, they're not going to attack one tiny little island in the middle of the Pacific. For one thing, American bomber planes flying from California to Hawaii often can't find the place, and they didn't have all the modern equipment that they have nowadays, and it's a very difficult spot to get to. So it was a total surprise. And I don't think you can blame the Americans for that, because it's hard to know what they could have done differently.
On the attack itself, would you say it was from a Japanese point of view, was it carried out in a brilliant fashion? Is that why they caused so much devastation?
The Japanese were very, very lucky, I think. The plan went wrong right from the beginning. The Japanese pilot in command fired a couple of flares, which were misinterpreted, and the Japanese all went in together, which was not the plan. And in fact, they were hugely lucky, and it worked very well. So, yes, they were successful. They could have been more successful if they had come back later and finished the job.
It's because I understand that the fact they didn't take out the American aircraft carriers was to have a very important long-term consequence in the war.
Yes, the aircraft carriers were a problem. The whole point of the attack was to knock out the aircraft carriers, and the aircraft carriers were always in harbour at weekends, which is why the attack was planned for a Sunday. That particular Sunday, the aircraft carriers were at sea. They were delivering aircraft to American places like Wake Island that were closer to Japan so that the Americans could defend themselves better. The Japanese admiral in command of the fleet knew after he had set sail that the aircraft carriers, the American aircraft carriers, had left Port Pearl Harbor. But by the time he discovered that, all the crews on the Japanese ships had been told where the attack was going to happen. They had been warned that it was Pearl Harbor. So the Japanese couldn't then go back to Japan and do it all again another time. They either had to go on or not attack at all. And the choice they made was to go ahead and do whatever damage they could. But in terms of knocking out the aircraft carriers, you can say that the attack was a total disaster.
The Japanese must have realised that they were going to awaken potentially the world's leading industrial power by attacking at Pearl Harbor. Did they really expect they could somehow win a war against the United States?
Lots of Japanese were very much against the war, and that would include, I think, you're never quite sure, Emperor Hirohito, and certainly Admiral Yamamoto, who helped to plan the attack, and also quite a lot of Japanese who were in the attack. They wondered how on earth they were going to beat a place like the United States. The answer is that they were hoping to have a very quick conquest of places like Malaya and Java and then negotiate. They didn't expect to defeat the United States. They expected to take control of the islands and places they needed to fuel their war effort in China. And once they had control, their assumption, quite erroneous, was that the Americans would do a deal. So it was really very foolish on Japan's part to make such a spectacular misassessment of the American character.
I understand you've read a lot of sources from people who actually witnessed the attacks on Pearl Harbor. What kind of sense do you get of the shock for these people when they saw this huge attack taking place?
Oh, I think it was absolute total shock. I mean, was a weekend. They were playing football. They were going to the cinema. They were all going to dances. It came completely out of the blue. Admiral Kimmel was well aware that an attack might happen. He was blamed after the attack for keeping all his battleships in harbour. His view was that they could be better protected by anti-aircraft guns in harbour, and it would save fuel, and they would be bigger targets outside harbour. So that all went wrong for him. But the thinking people who were running Pearl Harbour were well aware of the problem. But for ordinary people, it was a total shock.
And how quickly did the news of this attack spread around the world?
Well, that all comes down to Lord Mountbatten's nephew, who was a small boy called Noel Cunningham Reid, who had been sent to Hawaii for safety. They were getting him away from wartime Britain. And he was out playing in the garden of the house where he was staying when he saw all these Japanese planes come over. And he ran straight next door to the house of an American newspaper correspondent, knocked on his door, told the man that they were being attacked by the Japanese. And the American correspondent was in bed and not at all pleased to be woken by an 11-year-old English boy. But once he was persuaded to come to the door, quite naked, he saw the sky, he saw the planes, he ran back indoors, he put his trousers on, and he put a call straight through to the United Press office in San Francisco, telling them what had happened. In those days, you had to book telephone calls and send cables, and it was very difficult. But he was fortunate enough to book a call and get the cable out, and the news went to San Francisco and from there all around the world.
And so what was the reaction back in the United States when people heard the news of the attack on Pearl Harbor?
Half of them didn't believe it at first. They heard there'd been some shooting somewhere. In those days, most Americans didn't even know where Pearl Harbor was. They'd never heard of it. It took a long time to percolate. I say a long time, just a few hours. But by that evening, I think all Americans knew that something dreadful had happened. And, of course, they reacted in the same way as they did with the Twin Towers in New York in 2001. Stunned at first, and then growing anger, and then a demand for retribution all over America. Next day, all the recruiting offices were absolutely swamped with young men wanting to hit back.
And so was it pretty much a universal demand for America to wage war on Japan at this point?
Well, yes. I think they had a vote. When they had a vote in Congress, one person voted against the war, and that was a Republican lady congresswoman from, Montana, and she had voted against joining the war in 1917 as well. But she was the only vote in either of the two American houses who was against the war. Everybody else was 100% in favour.
Now, this mattered to a number of the other warring powers as well as America and Japan. Do we have a sense of what the reaction was back in Britain to the attack on Pearl Harbor?
Huge enthusiasm. I don't think anybody felt particularly sorry for the Americans who were killed. There's two stories out of Pearl Harbor. One is small air attack in Pacific, not many killed. And the other story is huge industrial power, world's mightiest industrial power, comes into the war on the side of the good guys. And that was the story in Britain. They were really, really pleased that America was coming in at last to help them win the war.
And do you think there would have been more sympathy for the Americans who lost their lives had this happened outside of a war?
Oh, yes. I mean, the American casualty rate outside the explosion of the USS Arizona was not large. To put it in context, on the day after Pearl Harbor, 10 Germans in Latvia killed 11,000 Jews. Each of them killed more than 1,000 Jews with one bullet hole in the head. So, I mean, a lot of people in Europe were dying all over the place. So it was, in the context of the European war, only a very small byproduct. It was the after effects of Pearl Harbor that were the big deal.
And what about at a leadership level? How did Churchill and Roosevelt react to this attack?
Roosevelt was hugely relieved when Pearl Harbor was attacked. Some people say that he knew it was coming. I don't think that's true. But the point for Roosevelt was that the gloves were off at last. He no longer had to pretend that he was neutral in the war between Britain and the Nazis and all of that. The gloves were off and he was on Britain's side and they could just go ahead and fight a war properly. The American cabinet met that afternoon and they all agreed. They were all just delighted. that they were no longer pretending that they were neutral. Churchill in London was hugely relieved as well. He was at dinner when he heard about Pearl Harbor, and he was very despondent about how the war was going. But when he heard the news, he spent the rest of the night dictating telegrams and saying to himself, well, we've won now. It's still going to be a long, hard road, but we cannot lose with the industrial muscle of the United States on our side. And it had interesting effects in places like Hollywood. They were filming Mrs. Miniver at the time of Pearl Harbor. And because the United States was neutral, and because the America First Society was very determined that America should stay neutral and not get involved, and there were Senate hearings saying America must not favor Britain in the war, that had affected the script of Mrs. Miniver. They weren't able to make the film they wanted because they had to stay neutral. MGM had big box office profits in Germany, and they had to make a film that didn't offend the Germans. But once Pearl Harbor had happened, and America was in on the side of the Allies, they were able to rewrite the script and make the film they wanted to make. And you can see that in Mrs. Miniver in the final part of the film, where the vicar in church stands up and tells the congregation what they're fighting for. And that speech was written immediately after Pearl Harbor. They wouldn't have been able to put it in before.
On the Axis side, what was the reaction of the Axis leaders to the Japanese attack? Did they know about it in advance, and how did they feel after it happened?
The Germans did not know about it in advance, probably quite wisely on the Japanese point of view. But then, no, they didn't know what was going to happen. And Hitler was exactly like Churchill. He too was at dinner gloomy about the prospects of the war. On the German side, the Germans were trying to capture Moscow by Christmas, and it wasn't working well. The Wehrmacht had run out of steam, and the Russians were mounting a counteroffensive, which was causing them a lot of trouble. And Hitler was very gloomy. He'd finished dinner. He was an hour ahead of Churchill in London, and he'd gone to his bunker when the news of Pearl Harbor was brought to him, and he was absolutely delighted, the same as Churchill. It's very odd, but they both were very pleased. And Hitler ran across the compound in the cold without his coat on to tell Field Marshal Keitel and Jodl what had happened. One of the things he said was that Japan had never lost a war in 3,000 years. That was going to be good for the Germans. I think he was hoping that all the military materiel that the United States had been providing to Britain and Russia would now be withheld because the Americans had to take care of their own interests first. And he thought that might be a chance to finish off the British and the Russians before the American industry could get going on a war footing. And he was, of course, quite wrong about that.
And do you have a sense of how the news of the attacks actually played out to ordinary people in Japan?
Ordinary people reacted much as people in America. They weren't outraged, but they were pretty shocked. A lot of Japanese came to the same conclusion as people all over the world, that the Japanese could not win this, and they wondered why they were doing it. But, of course, they're a very cohesive society, and once a decision has been taken, they all get behind it and back it. So they all turned up at the Emperor's Palace and cheered and bowed, and they were patriotic just like anybody else. But thinking Japanese knew it was very silly, and the American ambassador knew lots of sensible Japanese who apologized profusely for what was going on quietly, but not actually saying it's nothing to do with me, not me, Gov. That was what they were thinking. They didn't like it any more than anybody else.
Was it always going to end in disaster for Japan? Do you think there was any way that they might have somehow managed to either win the war or get the kind of negotiated peace they were looking for?
They weren't expecting to win a war against the United States. It was the negotiated peace. And that went wrong the minute they didn't sink the aircraft carriers. The whole strategy depended on the Americans not having aircraft carriers. The Japanese were doomed immediately. I think Yamamoto knew that. He wasn't part of the fleet that was attacking Pearl Harbor. He was at home in Japan. And he passed the decision to the admiral who was actually sailing there. He said, you decide what's best. I think he was just passing the buck there. They should have scratched the fixture and gone home once they knew that there were no aircraft carriers in Pearl Harbor. I mean, they could never have won the war. Instead, they went on a disastrous course that it ended up with two atomic bombs being dropped on their people. So it was not a good idea.
So when people talk about something like, say, the Battle of Midway being a turning point in the Pacific, in actual fact, was there really no turning point? Japan essentially was always doomed to defeat.
I would say the Japanese were always doomed to defeat. There's always a turning point where the losing side becomes the winning side. There often is such a turning point, and Midway was it. But no, the Japanese couldn't win. It's all a matter of sums and adding up who's got the military material, frankly, and the Japanese didn't have it.
And we're now very close to the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor. It's clearly one of the most well-known events in 20th century history. But do you think there's anything more we can learn or we need to understand about what happened then?
I think politicians can learn something, that they should never embark on a course that's going to end in disaster. But of course, the kind of people who start wars are A, not the people who are actually going to have to fight them, and B, they're people like Hitler, who was an all-or-nothing gambler. And if you allow a person like that to have power, unfettered power, without people around him restraining him, then they're always going to do these things. And that is something for people to think about.
That was Nicholas Best. His book, 7 Days of Infamy, Pearl Harbor Across the World, is out now in both the UK and the US, published by Thomas Dunn. And you can read an article by Nicholas in the Christmas edition of BBC History magazine, which goes on sale this week. Also in this issue, we have articles on the Charge of the Light Brigade, Henry VIII's Six Wives, Black Power, and the historical antecedents of Donald Trump. Our Christmas issue will be available in all good newsagents in the UK and internationally in our many digital formats. Outside the UK, it may still be an earlier edition that's currently in the shops. And if you'd like to take out a subscription, we currently have a great deal available for new subscribers in the United States, where you can try 3 issues of the magazine for a total of just $9.95, including postage. You can find out more and take advantage of this offer by visiting buysubscriptions.com/historyus.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Our second interview this week is with Carlo Rovelli, an Italian physicist and writer whose recent book, 7 Brief Lessons on Physics, was an international bestseller. His new book is Reality is Not What It Seems, The Journey to Quantum Gravity, which charts our changing understanding of time, space and reality from ancient times to the present. I spoke to him down the line recently to find out more. How important would you say ancient thinkers were to modern scientific development?
I would say crucial. We wouldn't have modern science without ancient science, there was a direct influence, more than a direct influence. I think in Europe, science started as an attempt to recover old science, Greek science, and even in the books of Newton, so we are well into the beginning of modern science. Newton even says in one of his books that the ancient knew a lot of things that had been lost. And he present some of his results as if he was just trying to catch back with antique knowledge, while in fact he was much more ahead of ancient knowledge.
And one of the stories that comes through a lot in the book is about the development of the atom. Can you tell us a little bit about how that idea first came about?
Yeah, the atomic idea is one of these typical ideas that was developed in ancient time and sort of was forgotten even, and came back via discovery of ancient texts. And modern atomists often refer to ancient idea. So it was a key idea in the philosophy of Democritus. Was one of the main philosophical schools in antiquity, both in Greece and later in Roman times. The debate at the time was, what is the world made of? What are the sort of the elementary constituencies of the world? It's just one thing. It's a collection of things. And there was this very general idea that we should be able to make sense of the world in terms of something simple. And what is this something simple? And Democritus and his school came out with the idea that perhaps the world could be understood just in terms of these atoms, namely these individual little things moving around in space, and everything is just made by that. The motivations were some based on observations, some based on some abstract considerations. I think the main motivation was perhaps that it's hard to think that we can take a piece of matter and break it at infinity. The resistance to the idea that something can be infinitely small or infinitely big or infinite. So Democritus came out with that. A lot of ancient physics was based on that. One of the schools of ancient physics, that was called the atomist physics. It was forgotten. And then there was the rediscovery of this fantastically beautiful poem by Lucretius, which is all about science and about Democritus' ideas. In fact, it's about the ideas of Epicurus, who in turn follows the physics of Democritus. And in modern time, that's how the idea that matter is made by little bits, by atoms, appeared. And it was long discussed, and it turned out to be finally confirmed only by Einstein. And this is a fantastically beautiful story. It's an old idea, 2 millennia old, which resurfaced, comes back, and Einstein finds a nice way to more or less prove it. Now we all know, now we have machines that we can actually see the individual atoms. So yes, matter is made by atoms, and the humanity figured it out through a long path, which is an old idea being confirmed in recent times.
And you've already hinted at this a bit, but why do you feel there seems to have been such a long gap in scientific progress between the ancient time and then the scientific revolution that doesn't come for maybe 1,000, 1,500 years?
I think in the history of civilization, this is a great question, and it's a question that deserves to be investigated more by historians, not by scientists like me. But definitely, let me put it in this way. I think in modern times, there's a resistance of viewing the Middle Ages as dark ages, right? I mean, Middle Ages were a rich period in which a lot of things happened and ideas were developed. But from the point of view of rational thinking of natural sciences, they were definitely dark ages. There's no doubt about that. Just take what we learn at school, in primary school, in middle school, and try to date when those things were first understood. Just what we learn at school, geometry, geography, grammar, basic literature, basic physics. And you get two peaks, one in sort of modern times and one around, I don't know, the 3rd century before the Common Era, so 3rd century before Jesus Christ. Geometry was invented at the time. Grammar was invented at the time. Geography was invented at the time. Optics was invented at the time, and so on and so on. It's a long list of things. So the humanity had a period of fantastic development of rational knowledge about the world, in the Greek period, and a second remarkable period in modern times, so after the Renaissance. It started with Galileo and Newton and all the way to now. In the between, there is this long period in which, at least around the Mediterranean, most of the ancient knowledge was lost, forgotten, discarded, and not considered important. Reasons are complicated. Certainly, the Roman Empire was one of the factors. So the Romans learned a lot from the Greek, but not in this domain. So Greek knowledge was lost in part with the Roman Empire. But especially, I think, is when the Roman Empire Christianized. So it went back to a structure of power connected to religion. And it was the end of these few centuries in which religion was only very loosely connected with power. And it went back to an older structure in which there was a dominant way of thinking and much less space. In fact, there was an explicit fight against everything which was considered rational thinking. It's something, I think, which I would like historians to look at it much more. One of the things, somehow, history of science is complicated because there are few people who understand science and history at the same time. I read a lot of history of science written from people who don't understand science. There are statements about Greek science which make no sense for a scientist. And of course, a scientist like me has only a weak understanding of how history should work. So, of course, there's wonderful history of science, but much less, I think, that what would be needed. I think that science is a historical process. It is still now a historical process. And science is better understood thinking historically, but also history is better understood understanding what was the science of the times.
And there's a point in your book where you talk about how the work of Dante hints at later scientific discoveries. Do you think that this shows how other fields can shed light on science?
Yes, Dante's intersection with science is it's a bit striking, and it's completely surprising, especially in modern terms. Dante was very cultured. He knew the science of the time. He was a very learned man, and he was an extremely intelligent man. But this doesn't seem to be enough for some fantastic intuitions that are in his poem. And the most striking one by far is that he gives a picture of the universe. His poem is a description of the universe as a whole. And he describes the geometry of the universe. And it's a remarkably non-classical, non-intuitive geometry, which is essentially the same that Einstein came about many centuries later. Technically, it's called the three sphere. It's a universe which is finite, but has no boundary. So it's a very completely geometrical construction. And Dante somehow clearly had the intuition about it. This was realized by some American mathematicians. But if you know the mathematics and you read Dante, it's totally obvious that he's talking about this mathematical idea. I think what it shows is that deep intuitions might go across disciplines, and there is a constant exchange. Well, in that case, it was not really an exchange because it didn't flow from Dante to Einstein. I don't think Einstein knew about it. But science is about having vision of the world that then makes sense rationally and experimentally and scientifically. Poetry is about having visions of the world that make sense for us emotionally. But again, we're always trying to understand the world, make sense of it. And it's the same enterprise. The methods are different, but the task is developing conceptual ideas, conceptual schemes for thinking about the world. So it's a common enterprise, I think, literature and natural sciences.
Another hugely important figure was Isaac Newton. From your point of view, how much is his contribution important to the development of physics over the next few hundred years?
It's probably the greatest physicist ever, Isaac Newton. He's the one who has been able to take all the advances, the steps ahead in the Renaissance from Copernicus, the discovery that the Earth goes around the Sun, and Galileo, and Kepler, Huygens. And it was a momentous change in our understanding of the world. And Newton took all that and brought all that together in this fantastic picture, which is Newtonian mechanics, which lasted for many centuries. It's the best basic understanding of the world that we had. Then it changed in the 20th century with Einstein, with quantum mechanics. But the fact it changed, it doesn't make Newton useless or didn't really overcome Newton in the sense that Newton remains the ground on which we have built more. It's not that Newton theory is wrong. Newton theory is just not wide enough to include the physics of the atoms, the physics of the universe as a whole, and the physics of things that go very fast. But it remains fantastically good physics. So science has great revolutions, right? We change our view of the world. We discover that the Earth is round. We discover that the Earth moves. We discover black holes, and space is different than what we thought, and time is different than what we thought. Time goes faster in some places and slower in ours. So it keeps changing our understanding of the world, but it doesn't mean that it makes old knowledge useless or wrong. It shows that old knowledge was imprecise and only good in some domain, but nevertheless good in those domains. So I think science is far more accumulative enterprise than what a lot of modern description of science and modern philosophy of science makes of it. It's true that we change idea, we discover that we were wrong all the time, but nevertheless, science is a cumulative enterprise. We everybody builds on the shoulder of the previous one, and some of the largest shoulders of all is Newton. We owe to Newton understanding how to do mathematical physics, how to do mechanics, how to write equations for the world, and then on that, we went ahead.
This year marks the centenary of Einstein's general relativity theory. Can you give us a sense of how important a moment that was for physics?
Major. I would say after Newton, the person who most understood to our present understanding of the world is Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein changed our understanding of space and time, made the first step toward quantum mechanics and therefore our understanding of matter. He started again, and essentially he did again what Copernicus and Newton did, so changed the rule of the game from basics. So his influence in physics has been immense. Having said so, I have been blamed, and I think correctly so, I think historians could appreciate this debate. I've been blamed because I tend to read the history of science as the contribution of a few giants, or actually I tend to present the history of science as the contribution of few giants, which of course is certainly incomplete. Science is a complex collective enterprise in which many people contribute, and it builds on all these contributions. But however, having said so, nevertheless, there's no doubt also that a few people make great steps. Albert Einstein is not just one article in which he put together other people's results. It's a remarkable number of works that he did, which building on what was around him changed our view of reality. Now, it's difficult to separate the contribution of few geniuses from the common contribution of everybody, but few geniuses certainly existed in the history of science and had an immense influence, and Einstein is one of the greatest of them, perhaps with Newton the greatest in physics.
And so we've talked about some of the, as you say, some of the really well-known figures such as Galileo, Copernicus, Einstein, Newton. Are there any other scientists who you feel should be better known for their contributions?
Yes, Dirac, I think, is a typical case. Dirac is with Einstein, the great scientist of 20th century, the great physicist of 20th century. And quantum mechanics was largely put together by Dirac on the basis of what other people had done before. The science of Dirac is very abstract and hard to synthesize and to explain, much harder than Einstein. Einstein, well, he understood the space curves and time curves, and that the gravitational waves, the black holes, these are not easy things to digest, but they're, you know, black holes are just stuff which are up in the sky, and we see them, and things fall inside them and don't come out. It's not so hard to get a sense of them. While Dirac contribution, namely clarifying quantum mechanics, it requires a much deeper diving into the complications of physics. And Dirac himself was such an incredibly strange personality, was probably autistic or nearly autistic, is one of these people who wouldn't talk, never show emotions, and he was a very nice guy, in fact, a very nice chap. There's a recent beautiful biography of him, but it was sort of unperscrutable as a man, and certainly he would deserve to be known as one of the great scientists of all times, while he doesn't have the recognition that names like Newton or Einstein or Darwin in different fields have.
Somebody like Einstein, obviously the work he did was very advanced, but there are, I think a lot of people around the world can understand some of his ideas. Do you think we've got to a point now where the work physicists are doing is so advanced that the general public just can't keep up with them?
No, I think that there is a delay between discoveries, new ideas, and when the general public gets them. This delay, it's intrinsic, it's necessary for many reasons. One is that it takes time to be sure that these ideas are right. So it wouldn't make sense for the large public to follow the last fashion, because the fashion maybe turned out to be wrong. So, for instance, when Copernicus understood that the Earth is not the center of the universe, nobody believed him for a while, not because people were stupid, it's just because the evidence was not very strong. I think an intelligent and cultured person, the generation after Copernicus, would probably have thought, correctly so, that, well, maybe he was right, but more probably was wrong. So there's this time, and plus there's a time to digest strange ideas, the idea that this move is strange. So it took a lot of time for everybody to understand what it means to the Earth to move. And now it took a century to confirm all Einstein ideas, and they've been confirmed in a spectacular way. So more and more people are curious to know what we have understood. And it takes time to understand what it means for time to slow down, for black holes to be holes in space, and it takes time. So there's time. And this time, I don't think is longer now than before, and I don't think that science is more difficult now than before. I think it has always been hard to digest new ideas. We will digest quantum mechanics and general relativity and the novelties in due time.
What discoveries of the last few years would you say people in the future might see as the kind of Einstein moment of our time?
We don't know. We don't know. In the last few years, there have been a spectacular set of experimental discoveries in physics, but they were all confirmations of old ideas. The most beautiful one has been last year with the gravitational waves. LIGO in America, this big antenna, has captured gravitational waves, which physicists thought that existed. It's an idea by Einstein. And a century later, here we are with a beautiful confirmation. And there was a discovery of the Higgs, which is a similar story, and other things like that. So what we have seen recently is confirmation of ideas. Now, some things people expected new to find, for instance, in particle physics, did not arrive. In cosmology has delivered us some funny novelties, for instance, dark matter. I mean, this is evidence that the universe is full of stuff we don't understand. Maybe this will turn out to be important, but we don't know. It's very hard to know what is important right now, because we're on the boundary between what we know and what we don't know. And again, science is a historical process. It's a slow historical process. And it's also slow today, in spite of the perception of speed. So it's a moving thing, and we're immersed in this moving thing. And like, it's hard to say what is the most important sort of historical, global, political process in the planet. Well, we sort of see it, but we might go wrong. Same in science. I think that we're figuring out quantum gravity. This is a great step ahead. Am I sure? No, not at all.
That was Carlo Rovelli. Reality is not what it seems. The Journey to Quantum Gravity is out now in the UK, published by Alan Lane. In the US, it's due to be published next month by Riverhead. And now it's time for this week's history news with our website assistant, Ellie Cawthorne.
48 skeletons, including the remains of 27 children, have been discovered in a Black Death burial pit at Thornton Abbey in Lincolnshire. The pit dates back to the 14th century, when bubonic plague epidemics are believed to have killed up to 60% of the British population. DNA testing of the skeleton's teeth revealed plague bacterium Yersinia pestis to be present. Archaeologist Dr. Hugh Wilmot suggested that the mass grave is an unexpected find, as despite the huge number of plague deaths, victims were generally still buried individually in parish churchyards. He stated that the pit sheds light on the real difficulties faced by a small community ill-prepared to face such a devastating threat. Mass burials are a sign of when the system has broken down. This community had obviously reached a point where it could not cope. In other news, a prayer book believed by some experts to have belonged to the young King Henry VIII is being put up for auction, with an estimated guide price of £2.5 million. The elaborately illustrated book dates back to 1500 and is one of few such examples to survive the Reformation. It also contains a rare image of Thomas Becket. Most pictures of him were later destroyed after Henry VIII outlawed the cult of the saint. Meanwhile, an Anglo-Saxon pendant discovered by a student in Norfolk has been officially declared treasure of national significance by the British Museum. Inlaid with garnets and dating back to the 7th century, the gold pendant was found in a grave believed to belong to a high-status Anglo-Saxon woman. Tom Looking, the 23-year-old history student who discovered the pendant in 2014, said that the incredibly rare find had certainly given me a good dissertation project.
Okay, well, that's about it for this week's episode, but please do listen in next time when we're going to be talking to a group of politicians who also double up as historians.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.